This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Good morning and welcome to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. I'm Jim Russ, in for Dr. Richard Schertz. Today on the show, we're going to have two profiles in IT for you. One about Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. The other is about the guy within Apple who made most of the products you know and love look like what they look like. His name is Jonathan Paul Ive. We're also going to talk later in the show, food science, about cooking with alcohol.
And so now it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Bob writes, Dear Tech Talk, I never send fan mail to a radio show, but I have to tell you that Tech Talk is the best radio show about technology on the air. I love it, and I tell my friends to listen too. Thanks.
Well, that's great.
Bob in Maryland. What a great email.
I know.
We love to get
How
that
nice.
Kind of email. Yeah. You can, you know, if you have more of those kind of emails, just send them to techtalk@stratford.edu.
And not the, would you guys just shut up? And,
that's right. Yeah, I don't like that
the,
kind of email.
Those I don't like either.
No, I don't like those. We got an email from a Maryland listener. Dear Dr. Richard Schertz, I use Windows Live Mail and have a Verizon Fios account with 7 subaccounts. I went to add a new subaccount recently and things got all screwed up. I've tried to troubleshoot this and found a warning on Broadband Report's website that says there's an issue with IE8 and Verizon subaccounts. Evidently, when trying to make changes to the Verizon subaccount, IE8 displays the table incorrectly, and when you click to add an account, you're actually clicking on deleting the account.
Oh, good.
So that's, and Verizon will not reinstate my email account once I've deleted them. I hope you can help with this. I'd also like to learn more about Windows Live Mail account activation steps. Teach me how to figure this out for myself. Please do that, because nobody at Verizon is going to help me. Apparently, the Maryland listener has been trying to call Verizon, and their help desk is really not really available.
I had problems with Verizon, too, which is why I now use AT&T.
So that's always a problem. Maryland listener, I did check out this problem on lost subaccounts, and I checked out. There was one reference that I found. That's the same reference that you found on broadbandreports.com, that somebody had gone to the with an IE8, and they deleted their subaccount. I could not find any references at all other than that one about that particular problem. I found no references in the Verizon account. Now, what I would suggest is that you go back with another browser like Chrome or Foxfire because the person that had the problem with IE8 said other browsers work. Go back with another browser and see whether you can see your subaccounts there with another browser. And it could very well be that IE8 is displaying the table improperly. Okay, well now we have another email. Let me just finish these emails.
Finish the emails.
I'm going to get to the secret visitor.
The reason why we're laughing.
Dr. Bird has just walked in.
Yeah, well, I guess you could have guessed that.
Read your email.
Okay, we've got an email from, by the way, Windows Live, Maryland listeners, not actually a real email account. It's an email consolidator. And so what it does, you can connect all of your email accounts, and you can read in one client all your email accounts. So you could connect Yahoo, Gmail, Hotmail. Now, you cannot go to Verizon and ask them how to use it. So what you want to do is Windows Live has a great description on how to use it and a great tutorial on the website. Go to explore.live.com/Windows Live Mail. Or you can just Google Windows Live Mail and it'll take you to that page. It's a very simple explanation. I'd recommend you use that. We got an email from Jim. Dear Tech Talk, I was on a dating site.
Oh boy. That's why you showed up, isn't it, Bird?
and I met somebody on there. I sent her an email, and she never responded.
Probably that photo attachment.
Now I'm wondering, now that she knows my email address, can anything bad happen? Like, could she send me a virus?
Could anything bad happen?
Wow.
Or could I have my account cleaned out? I'm using Gmail. Thanks, Jim.
This guy's new to the show, isn't he?
Number one, yeah. Computer dating bad.
Okay, now here's the thing, Jim. Now, a lot of times people use throwaway email accounts.
Right.
So what you want to do is you could create a Gmail, another Gmail account or a Yahoo account.
Like studmuffin at gmail.com,
yeah.
Since he's on.
And what you do is you set up another Gmail account. And when you're dealing with somebody you don't really know whether you trust them or not, use the throwaway account.
Right.
And then after you have been they've established some credibility. Like if she answers
the call, is that, what,
is that what they call that? Really?
Yeah. Credibility is in the eyes of the beholder.
That's right. It's a family show.
Yeah. To achieve some credibility, then you could switch them over to your real email account.
Yeah,
now, here's one of the problems. Now, could they get any information from your email account? Here's the problem. It is possible if you use that same email account all over the place. Like if you log on to blogs and use your email account, and they Google your email account, anytime you've listed it anywhere, it shows up. So they may be able to link you to real information if you've used that account in other places.
Great.
So actually, it's always useful, I would say, if you want to know what people can know about you, put in your email address and see what people pull up on you when they Google it.
Or you can just go to bars like the rest of us do.
That's right. Okay. Thanks a lot for that email. Thanks a lot for that email, Jim. Listen, any further questions on these dating sites, just talk to Dr. Bird.
Dbird at loveline.com.
We got an email.
You can find me at lovemetender.com. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, now we got an email from Robert. Dear Tech Talk, I'm interested in technology and computers. I hope to start my career soon, but where should I be focused? Love the show, Robert. I love this kind of question.
Send them to the Apple store.
Yeah, it's always good there. Well, I'll tell you, Robert, the thing is, if you're in technology, you know, things are always moving. So you want to know where technology will be in 5 years.
Right, yeah.
So, like, you really don't want to be, say, a server jock because, you know, servers are going away. Everything's going to become virtualized in the cloud. So we're really moving away from the, you know, a lot of hardware infrastructure into all the cloud-based computing service, you know, software as a service. So I would look at all these virtualized services. Security is not going to go away. You really want to get into security.
Security.
Information mining, data mining,
data.
Information assurance is all extremely important. And see, Dr. Bird knows all of this because he's always data mining to come up with nuggets.
He's freaky right along with you.
Also, check the standards because, you know, the standards change slowly and you can sort of project where things are going to go. Like TCP/IP, the protocol on the Internet, developed in the summer of 1973, it's been around for a lot of years. And so if you check the standards, you can sort of project where things are going to go. I'd also read the industry rags. These are these free industry magazines you can read. Join user groups and go out and talk to users. Actually act like you're already professional and ask questions. So what you want to do is act like you're already in the field, and then you'll be in the field.
Wow.
So, host emeritus,
yes,
Dr. Bird, to what do we owe the pleasure?
Well, I just want to come down and kind of bask in the glow of the new release of the next generation iPhone.
Funny, the 4S.
I'm sure, well, I'm a little disappointed. I understand.
The iPhone for Steve.
The iPhone for Steve. Is that what that was all about?
That's what people are saying.
Yeah, everybody's poo-pooing this because they're expecting a 5 version.
No, here's the thing.
But I like it.
Did you get one?
I've ordered it.
Actually, Dave, I got to tell you, I'm going to get one.
Uh-oh. Our world has come crashing down.
I have to tell you.
You got it now?
It's a 3.
It's a shame.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
Well,
I like it for the voice commands.
Yeah, the voice commands are good.
So I don't have to go into the calendar and do all this
stuff. That's that Siri voice, S-I-R-I, voice command. And actually, it's gotten great reviews, this Siri voice, because they find, you know, Apple always makes things very usable.
Hey, Jim, who is this guy?
Dr. Richard Church
is
Stratford University.
You like the iPhone? Really?
Let me tell you what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting for...
Did he get a leather jacket? Swag here? What?
No.
I've been waiting
for
a world phone that had both GSM as well as CDMA.
Right.
This finally has it. Both.
Hey, give me some skin, brother.
Both.
All right.
See, the thing is, I knew iPhone 4 was going to come out with it because the iPhone 4 had both radios in it. But if you got Verizon, it just took the CDMA radio. If you got AT&T, that hooked the GSM radio.
Right.
You knew they were going to hook up both radios
they had
soon.
They did that.
So the iPhone 4 has both, and that's what I've been waiting on.
I can see you with this application because you are so busy, so multi-talented, so multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what do you want?
President of a major university, running a couple of shows here, international traveler.
What do you want from him?
I don't want anything. I'm just glad he's finally come over to the bright side.
God, you know,
left the dark side.
Why is it such a personal crusade?
No, he left. He left the blueberry.
Mm-hmm.
No,
Blackberry.
Sorry. Excuse me.
And now here's the thing. Now, actually, it was a fairly modest overall improvement. They added the voice commands.
Right.
Then they added an 8-megapixel camera.
Right.
From a 5-megapixel camera, but I don't actually think people have the iPhone for the camera.
No,
I don't think that was.
I beg to differ with you, Doctor.
Really?
I've been using that at the mothership.
You have?
And I take some great photographs and great videos. As a matter of fact, with this upgrade,
has 1080p.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, what they do, they've got a dual core processor, so they can handle more frames. So they've got a 1080p high resolution video, 1080p, mm-hmm. which is actually quite good, and that's because of the dual core processor. It's a world phone. Unbelievable. Now they also say it's got faster uploads and downloads.
Yeah,
so you guys, I mean, but you got to buy it. Now here's the thing: it doesn't support 4G, cell phone technology. It's just still 3G, right. And that's a battery life problem. Every time you go with 4G, your battery only lasts about an hour and a half, and so I don't think they've solved the battery life problem on the 4G.
AT&T doesn't have the true 4G. They've got the 3G on steroids.
Right. Yeah. Well, see, Verizon has 4G, but the Verizon 4G phones, their batteries only last about 3 hours. They're actually worse than the iPhone.
AT&T, the battery's much more improved. I mean, I get a whole day. It used to be I'd have to charge it halfway through.
Yeah. On your iPhone?
Yeah.
The batteries have gotten better, but not if you would be 4G. The 4G really uses a lot of energy. I think it's but who needs the 4G? Because now that they're putting on these capped data plans, really people don't need that extra speed.
Unless your grandfather.
Right. What phone do you have? The 4G?
I've got what they call the 4G.
Yeah. Okay.
And now you've got now you've ordered the 4G.
I've ordered the for nothing else, just to organize so I can do the voice commands. You automatically go to the calendar. It updates your PC at home. It does it all. I just love it.
Mm-hmm. Now, so I've been using. I got voice commands on my BlackBerry.
Of course you do, Doc.
I've been using voice commands for years.
Jimmy and I are just mortals. We're just hanging around.
I've also got voice commands on my navigation system in the car. Now, what is funny?
Yeah, and I'll bet he's got a British accent on the voice coming.
Now, let me tell you
British
something.
British female accent.
Have you ever noticed that you have to train your navigation system on your voice?
Yes, you do.
So I went into my wife's car and trained it on my voice.
Nice job. So Marianne gets lost.
So what happens is she tells it to do something, it doesn't listen. I say it and the car and it listens to me immediately.
Boys, I gotta leave, but thanks for letting me come down here and see another side of you, Doc.
I know.
You're shocked. See, you learned something
floored.
Today.
I can't believe it.
I tell you,
I was taking half the fun out of coming down here. I was excited about this. I have one too. I know.
When did you think I was gonna get one?
Listen, when I get my iPhone 4S.
Well, in other words, when Marianne wins something,
I'm waiting for her to win it. That's the problem. I've been waiting. And she,
wife wins everything.
Can we get, like, if she gets the new iPad, can you give it to one of us? She gets the old one, probably.
She's got to go, boys. I'll see you later.
Okay.
Bye,
all right. Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Thanks, David Bird, everybody. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Learn everything you ever wanted to know about this show by going to techtalkonline.com. Send the doc an email there, and we'll answer your question live here on the program. Learn more about our sponsors, Stratford University, by going to their website, stratford.edu. Tech Talk continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford
University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. You are indeed listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Stephen Paul Jobs.
Was there any question?
There was no question about that. Stephen Paul Jobs, co-founder, of course, chairman and CEO of Apple, known affectionately as Steve. Steve Jobs was born February 24, 1955, in San Francisco, California. His mother was a graduate student. His father was going to school there. They weren't married, and their parents did not want them to get married. So they gave Steve up for adoption. He was a graduate student. They gave him up for adoption.
I didn't know that.
And they found a parent. They found a couple who actually wanted a child. It was a medical doctor. And so when Steve was born, they called him and said, "Hey, Steve's been born. You know, our son's been born. The baby is ready for you to pick up." And they said, "Oh, we decided we wanted a girl." So they didn't take Steve.
Uh huh.
And so then the mother, who was a graduate student, wanted to only give up her child for adoption if it was to a couple that was college educated.
Right.
That was the key. That's why she went with the first couple. So she went to the next couple on the list, called them up, and this was Paul Jobs and Clara Jobs from Mountain View, California, and they took Steve. And then a few days later, his mother realized that neither one of them had a college degree, so she refused to sign the adoption papers. They had a big negotiation, and finally Paul and Clara said, "Look, we will guarantee that we send Steve to college." And when they guaranteed that, she allowed them to adopt Steve. And so Steve ultimately did start college. He didn't graduate. Mm-hmm. And that's the rest of the story.
That wasn't part of the deal.
No.
They sent him to college.
They did. Jobs attended the Cupertino Junior High School and then Homestead High School in Cupertino, California. While he was going through high school, he'd go to the after-school lectures. He'd go after school to lectures at Hewlett-Packard, the Hewlett-Packard company in Palo Alto, California. He was later hired by HP as a summer employee, and that's where he met Steve Wozniak. One of the guys, Steve Wozniak, was sort of a hardware hacker. They called him Woz.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, he co-founded Apple with Steve Wozniak. Now, following high school graduation in 1972, Steve enrolled in Reed College in Portland. It was a fairly expensive college. His parents were not that wealthy. They had saved the entire time that Steve was growing up so that he could go to college. And Steve was there at college in Portland, going to school and spending their money. And he said, you know, he's looked at his parents, they'd saved their whole life, and he was just blowing through all their savings. And he said, you know, I'm sitting here at Reed College, I don't even know what I want to do in life.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I don't even know whether this college stuff is even relevant to that's anything useful. And he said, and he just didn't want to waste his parents' money. So he dropped out after a semester. But what was interesting, after he dropped out, he dropped back in audited classes for about a year and a half. And he said when he dropped back into audit classes, he really started learning things because he took what he wanted to take instead of what was required. Now, he didn't have any money, so he was sleeping on the floor of his friends' apartments. He collected Coke bottles to get enough money for food. and that once a week he would walk 7 miles to the Harry Kushner Center, and he would get a free meal. And so he did this for a year and a half, just sort of, and he said that what he learned while he dropped back into college had a tremendous impact on him. For instance, one class he took was calligraphy.
Uh-huh.
It turned out Reed College had this fantastic calligraphy department. They had calligraphy all over the place. And so he took this course, and he learned all about multiple typefaces, proportionally faced fonts, and he just thought that this artwork of calligraphy was beautiful. And he just really, really impacted him quite dramatically. And ultimately, that course is what's responsible for the great calligraphy which was on the Macintosh, because he felt that was extremely important. I'll get back to that a little bit later. In 1974, Jobs joined the Homebrew Computer Club with his friend Steve Wozniak. And they would go there, and Steve Wozniak, of course, was making hardware, and Steve was there trying to figure out what to do with the hardware. Steve Jobs was not really a hardware guy. He could see how you could use something for hardware. Well, he took a job as a technician at Atari because he was still trying to find himself. You see, he dropped out of Reed, took this calligraphy class. He didn't really know that he was going to use that for computers yet. He hadn't connected the dots, as Steve said. And he wanted to find himself, so he wanted to save money for a trip to India. And he wanted to go to India, meditate, and find out who he was. And so he saved enough money working at Atari. And then he finally traveled with a friend from Reed College to India. And he was in search of spiritual enlightenment while he was there. And while he was in India, he converted to Buddhism. And he came back with his head shaved, wearing traditional Indian clothing, as a Buddhist. He went back to Atari to work for a while, and he said, you know, this working these video games isn't much fun. He got Wozniak to come in, because he was supposed to work on a circuit board. He brought Woz in to come back and help him with this circuit board, and that was always the sort of the yin-yang relationship. Steve Jobs would get the idea, then Wozniak would sort of put the hardware together to make it work. So they did that for a while, but finally they just got fed up with Atari and they quit. And in 1976, Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Ronald Wayne founded Apple. Jobs had convinced Wozniak to assemble a computer, and then Jobs said, I'll sell it. Now, in the beginning, this was the Apple One. Now, if you remember back then, everybody was like really interested in like building their own hardware, and everybody's into hardware. And so they said, why don't we get a box that has... Why don't we get a box and we'll put the circuit board in there, and then the people, when they want their computer, they can buy the keyboard and buy the monitor and assemble the computer, but they don't have to actually worry about the circuit board. So we built the Apple One. And then they started distributing it, and then some guy at a store said, you know, if you would, put a keyboard with this computer and maybe a monitor so you could just buy it and use it, you might sell it to more people. So all of a sudden the light went off, and they came up with Apple II. And the idea here with the Apple II was, instead of selling it to hardware guys, they would actually make it useful so some guy that was only interested in software could use it. He didn't have to tinker with the hardware. And the Apple II just took off. I mean, it just took off. And they just started selling like gangbusters, because for the first time, people that weren't like hardware geeks could actually have a computer. It started growing, and they hired actually one CEO back in 1980 who was with National Semiconductor. And then in 1983, they said, you know, this is a consumer product. Let's hire John Sculley, who's like CEO of Pepsi-Cola. He'll know how to sell this consumer product. So they hired John Sculley to come in here, and, you know, to market the Apple II. And the following year, Apple aired the Super Bowl ad titled 1984. Do you remember that ad?
I don't remember it, no.
It's where these people were like marching in drones, repeating everything, and that was the people who were doing the PC. And all of a sudden, the people that broke all the rules were Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had the Windows drones, and were, you know, the drones. And then Apple just changed everything. It was actually a very dramatic ad. You can look it up. It's actually on the web. And then January 24th, 1984, was when Jobs introduced the Macintosh. That was a huge, huge. That was actually when they really had the graphical user interface. And the Mac was where all of his efforts in calligraphy paid off. He started putting in proportional fonts and different kind of fonts into the Mac. And he said if it wouldn't have been for that calligraphy class that he just dropped in on while he was just auditing classes at Reed College, probably computers would not have variable-based fonts. Before that, they were all fixed-pitch fonts, you know, where the I had the same amount of space as a C. Whereas variable-space fonts, the I has less space because it's a thinner letter, and a variable-space font is easier to read. It's easier to read, and it's more appealing artistically.
Right.
So he put the these fonts on the Mac, and as he said in his commencement address he gave at Stanford, since Windows copied everything the Mac did, then the Windows machines had variable-space fonts. So he probably influenced typography as it relates to computers forever because of that particular class.
Mm.
But then what happened after the Mac was released, actually the computer field sales began to drop. This was like a kind of a mini recession for computer technology. It started dropping off, and Steve wanted, of course, to get more technology, be more innovative, and then Scully, the Pepsi-Cola guy, said, wait a minute here, we've got to get a commodity, we've got to commoditize, we can't be increasing costs. And they actually had a division of a splitting of the ways, and they just had complete disagreement over the direction that Apple should go. Scully went to the board, and the board fired Steve Jobs. He was fired from the company that he started, and he was 30 years old. And he said, you know, I listened to him talk about this at this Stanford commencement address, and he said, you know, for about 3 or 4 months, he felt like a failure. And he felt like he let down all the entrepreneurs there in Silicon Valley, the young entrepreneurs. He'd failed at his first big company, and he sort of didn't have a direction. And then after 3 or 4 months, he realized that actually he loves technology. And nobody is stopping him from doing what he loves. So he's just fine. I'll just do what I love. So he started Next Computer. This was NEXT. He'd gone to talk to a graduate student at Stanford, and they were doing protein folding experiments, and like she was trying to do the software and understand how proteins fold, and she was getting all wrapped around an axle and trying to get enough processing speed and working on the computer. And he said, wouldn't it be great if I could have a workstation for academics so that somebody working on protein folding wouldn't have to be a computer expert, and they could have a high-power workstation right there that would be as easy to use as the Macintosh. And that was sort of the genesis of Next Computer, to make a high-end workstation for educational operations. So he worked on the Next Computer, and it was really a hardware company. After about a year, he started with $7 million, by the way. He just threw all of his savings into it. $7 million. After about a year, he was running out of money. Because he didn't have a product yet. Mm-hmm. Didn't really have a product direction yet. Too much of a direction. And he convinced Ross Perot to invest in Next Computer.
Wow.
I didn't realize that. So Ross invested in Next Computer. And they finally released their first workstation in 1990. So he started it in 85. It was 5 years before they released the first workstation. Mm. And this workstation sold for $10,000.
Yeah.
It was actually extremely advanced and so expensive that nobody would buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much not many people did buy it. It was 1990. It turned out Tim Berners-Lee, who was the developer of the World Wide Web, he bought one. That was good, but they didn't really sell that many. Then he came up with what's called the Next Cube. He took this whole thing and put it into like a magnesium cube, which is very beautiful, like a piece of art. And the Next Cube really didn't sell. It was also expensive. Ultimately, Next only sold about 50,000 computers, and they weren't making that much money at all. So in 1993, he said, you know, maybe we should become a software company since this hardware is not going along anywhere. So they developed what they call Next Step. It was an operating system based on Unix BSD, and it was object-oriented. It was a very good development for an operating system. Then in 1996, developed WebObjects, which was an object-oriented program for developing web application. In 1996, get this, Apple announced that they would buy Next Computers for $429 million. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So they bought it. Apple bought it. And they brought Steve Jobs back. In 1996, he was gone for 11 years, about 11 years. They brought him back and made him interim CEO. Immediately, he ended some of the initiatives of Scully. Like, Scully had gone into this Mac cloning business. He wanted to make Macintosh computers like Dell computers. They got rid of the cloning program, and he immediately started working on innovative ideas that Scully had been dumping on because he wanted to make it a commodity. So he came out with the iMac, which was a very, very successful product, and it started a whole series of i products. The iMac was the first of them. And what really Steve Jobs did, see, there were a lot of engineers with good ideas. He was able to listen to the engineering ideas and give them enough feedback from a consumer perspective to help them craft the technology and fit the constraints so that it would meet the needs of the consumer and still be affordable. Then he came up with the iPod portable music player. Now, of course, the guy who had the iPod idea, Steve hired him, but he recognized that. He molded that. And the iPod actually changed the way digital music was distributed. And he set up the iTunes store. Now, it turns out that this next computer was quite important because WebObjects, which was a next computer software project, was used to develop the Apple Store, the MobileMe services, as well as the iTunes Store. Next step operating system was morphed into the Macintosh operating system 10, OS X. So he ended up pulling in all of the software technology from Next. And that fueled the sort of the next impetus and the next advances within Apple. In 2007, Apple entered the cell phone business with the introduction of the iPhone. Now, there was a second company that he started while he was working on Next computers. In 1986, he bought the graphics group from Lucasfilm for $10 million. He later renamed it Pixar. Now, what he wanted to do was make high-end graphics processing hardware. So they worked on this thing for 5 years, and nobody would buy their hardware. It was a super expensive hardware. Nobody would buy it, and finally he got the idea, I've got this great graphical software and hardware. Why don't we make our own animated movies? So it was like the second idea for Pixar, and they got a contract with Disney to produce computer animated features, and their first one was Toy Story, and then they had Finding Nemo. They had a whole series of them, which were hugely successful. By 2006, get this, Disney purchased Pixar for $7.4 billion, and it was an all-stock deal, and that gave Jobs 7% interest in Disney.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just created that because he was thrown out of Apple.
That, and basically, that the idea for what he intended to do it, use it for, was a failure because nobody wanted it. It was too expensive.
It was too expensive. So then
he
found
another use for it.
So he just repositioned it. And so, let's go back and you can sort of see a theme into what he was doing. He always followed his dream.
Mm-hmm.
He never really tried to, follow the path that everybody else did. And in his presentation at Stanford, he said, he didn't know the significance of his journey until he looked backwards. He couldn't connect the dots until he looked backwards. Looking forward, he had no idea that this calligraphy class would be that important. Looking back, it changed everything. Now, the other thing that he discovered in his life, when he was thrown out of Apple in 1985, he was 30 years old, thrown out of the company that he started, and he realized that what really made a difference was that you do something that you love. And it actually didn't matter what it was, and he said he could still do that. Mm-hmm. And so he really wasn't worried about that. And the final thing that he did, and I think this came from his experiences for spiritual enlightenment, he lived every day like it was his last day. And every morning he'd get up, he says, if this were my last day, what I'm going to do today, would that be what I would like it to be?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, if you have two or three days where the answer's no, you've got to change something.
Right.
And so he'd always do that. And he said, when you have that perspective, It makes things really simple. Some people, you know, they just they're afraid to take a chance. They say, oh, I've got all this. If I take a chance, I'm going to lose everything. But if it's your last day, you just go for it. And he says this last day philosophy had really impacted him quite dramatically through his whole life. So he's really kind of a spiritual guy, and he's kind of a counterculture guy. He also said in his in some of his other writings, you know, when he was, you know, trying to find himself and going to India, he experimented with LSD. And he said, I mean, he didn't do it that long, but he said the experiences with LSD were transformative for him. It helped awaken him. So he always felt that was transformative. His calligraphy class was, his trip to India was. And so he was quite an exceptional guy. Now, he's listed on 338 U.S. patent applications or patents. He's either listed as the primary one or a co-author of the patent. His estimated wealth in 2010 was $8.3 billion. His estimated wealth in 2011 is $7 billion because the stock market's gone down a little bit. In August of around 2006, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and they thought that it was a form of cancer that they could actually operate on. After he got that diagnosis, he didn't accept it. And he didn't want to have traditional medical treatment. He went 9 months trying to do alternative medicines and doing this and that. And finally, that wasn't working. So he went in and had it operated on, and they thought they got all of the cancer. But actually, since 2006, he hasn't really fully recovered. And ultimately, I think the pancreatic cancer came back. He resigned as CEO of Apple only a month ago. In August 5th, just this week, he died at age 56, really too young.
Yeah.
But he made a difference, and you can just see the outpouring from just every man who's used his computers because he's made technology accessible to everyone. After the break, I want to do a little bit more introspection on Steve Jobs and sort of, you know, what he means and the technology and where it's going.
You are listening to the virtual classroom of the airwaves, Tech Talk Radio. If you're listening on your radio this Saturday morning, you're listening on one of these fine radio stations in the Washington, D.C. area, WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, WTOP FM HD2 Washington. Hope you're paying close attention to profiles and IT about Steve Jobs, because when we come back, we'll have your chance to answer a question about that profile in IT and then maybe win a prize. So stay tuned. Tech Talk Radio continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, 5 of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Schertz. It's this guy right here.
I am the duly appointed individual, appointed specifically, solely, and strategically by Dr. Richard Schertz to administer today's pop quiz. And as I am the adjunct professor of pop quizzes, I am easy. I come up with simple things to ask you so that you can win free food at the Escoffier at Stratford University Fine Dining on the Falls Church campus or at Cafe Kareem in Woodbridge. We talked about Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple and Profiles in IT. And as you know, he was adopted. His birth parents wanted him to go to college, and he did. But for one semester, I need you to tell me which college Steve Jobs went to. If you're the first person with the correct answer, you win those tickets. Dial now, 877-936-9333. If you're calling from west of Palo Alto, California, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. This is Tech Talk Radio.
I want to talk briefly about the impact of Steve Jobs. He made technology accessible by allowing every man to see its potential. He was not actually an electronics guy. He wasn't really a programmer. I would say he was more of an artist. He was more of a communicator. And he was able then to connect with the user, and he was actually able to apply his artistic bent toward the technology. The computer was never his focus. It was always the user. Everything was about the user. And he was always kind of an anti-establishment guy. You go back to his counterculture. He was the drugs. He was going to India to find himself. This was back during the time of the big protest. And it was always the little guy against the establishment. And this was everything that he did was always with that idea. For instance, when he came up with the iPod, he negotiated with all the record companies to develop a different way to distribute music. So, which was really the way people had always wanted. You buy it by the song instead of getting stuck with an album that's got two songs that you like and you've got eight songs you don't like.
Right.
And so he basically made music distribution meet the needs of the user. And then when he came up with the cell phone, he went to the telephone companies. And before that, the phone companies would basically get a phone. They would modify the software. They would sell all of their products. They'd put a lot of stuff on there that the user didn't want just so they could, like, milk the user for more. And Steve said, look, if you're going to have the iPhone, we're going to put the software on, and you, Mr. Phone Company, cannot change it. And he made the first phone that was actually wrapped around the user experience. And so it was like the little guy against the phone company. So he was a creator, an artist, and he used really technology as his palette.
Mm-hmm.
He was a perfectionist. He wanted everything to be perfect. Even when he was making his first Apple One, he wanted all the wires in the circuit board to all be lined up perfectly. So you open it up, and it's like the circuit board is like a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's just really important. He was a perfectionist in function. He would want everything designed exactly so that the user could use it very easily, very intuitive. Even in manufacturing, he'd go to the manufacturing plants. He would go in. He said he expected the floors of the manufacturing plant to be clean enough to eat off of. And so he'd go in there. They'd clean them off. They'd line up everything. And he said, look, if you automate manufacture, if you keep everything clean, if you keep it organized, you can scale up, and you can scale up fast. He also pursued what he loved. He always followed his passions. He was never worried about making money in particular, although he made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he would always do what he enjoyed doing. And he was hoping, as he sort of meandered through life, taking his calligraphy class, doing this, doing that, that would all add up and the dots would connect, and they certainly did. He always was deeply concerned about his customers and what their experiences would be. So whenever he would talk to the engineers, he represented the customer. Now, he said you can't go out and survey customers because if you ask customers what they want, since they don't know what the potential of technology is, they're going to tell you what they want in terms of yesterday's technology. And he's thinking about tomorrow's technology, so he can't actually survey the customers. So he has to represent the customers, and he has to help meld the technology. He has to force it to do something beyond what we currently have, and frequently that would force engineering innovation that could deliver something that would be very cheap yet very powerful. He lived, as I said earlier, he lived every day until he was, as though it was his last, and that really influenced what he was doing. He really did change the way computers are viewed, the way they're used worldwide. You can go to any elementary school and see that. We'll miss Steve Jobs and all the creation that he did, and we hope that that Apple Computer will continue to innovate and thrive with his vision.
Today we're going to talk about Jonathan Paul Ive, I-V-E. Jonathan Paul Ive is the principal designer of the iMac, the aluminum PowerBook G4, the Mac Pro, MacBook Pro, the iPod, and the iPhone. He's casually known as Johnny Ive. Johnny Ive was born February 1967 in London, and grew up in Chingford, Essex. Yeah, that's right. In interviews, that would be in England, of course. In interviews, Jonathan has spoken about always being interested in the construction of objects as a child and a fascination with taking those objects apart. After attending school in the south of England, he moved to the north of England to study art and design at Newcastle Polytechnic, which is now Northumbria University. In 1985, he graduated with first-class honors, having created a pebble-shaped concept for a product to replace cash and credit cards in his final year project. A pebble-shaped product. Isn't that like trading with beads?
Yeah, I was carrying marbles around in your pocket. Yeah.
In 1990, Jonathan moved to London and co-founded his own design studio called Tangerine with Martin Derbyshire. He created projects ranging from hair combs and power tools to televisions and ceramics. Now, Jonathan's biggest contract was with Standard Ideal, where he designed toilets, seeking inspiration from marine biology books.
I wish there were pictures. I'm going to see if I can find pictures of that while you're talking.
Apple Computer was a client of Tangerine, and Jonathan made a sample laptop computer design and showed it to Steve Jobs, and they liked it. So he joined the Apple team. Now, this was, however, at the low point of Apple. Immediately after he was hired by Apple, Steve Jobs was ousted in a boardroom coup orchestrated by John Sculley. Do you remember that?
I sure do, yes.
Now, after Sculley came on board, he's just looking at the bottom line, he outsourced all the design work. This was when they were going to have third-party apps running on Apple computers, and Apple was losing grounds to Microsoft Windows day by day. Actually, Johnny Ive almost quit because he, as a designer, he joined full-time, and then they outsourced the design work. But in 1997, Steve Jobs returned and began to revive Apple's fortune and return it to the industry leader that it is today. Now, Johnny Ive was instrumental in this turnaround. The first thing he did after Jobs came back, he says, "Are there any designs in the back room that have been deep-sixed by Sculley?" Bingo! Johnny came up with all of his designs, and Steve loved them. And that was the beginning of the new Apple look. Under the new Jobs-led Apple, I was promoted to Senior Vice President of Industrial Design, and he launched the visually stunning iMac G3, and that was regarded as the birth of what they now call the new Apple. And that brought Jonathan to the attention of everybody outside of Apple because it was quite a nice design. From the iBook to the PowerBook, all of Apple's products have met with universal acclaim and became instant masterpieces. Jonathan brought simplicity, elegance, innovation to everything he touched. The minimalist styling of the iPhone with only one button on the front is the signature of Johnny Ive. See, I always thought maybe the iPhone is really the Ive phone.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever think about that?
That's interesting.
I'm thinking about it now. I wonder where the iPod, the iPod, or the iMac.
The iMac.
I mean, if I were the designer, it'd be the S-Mac. But that's Smack.
And
that's no good.
No, it's not.
No, and so I wonder whether the I, or I always thought the I stood for Internet, but now I'm thinking maybe it stands for Ive. Now, Jonathan's work is influenced by many things. The original color-candied iMac had its roots in gumdrops. He wanted to make a computer that looked kind of like a gumdrop.
Mm-hmm.
The transparent Apple mouse came from thinking about how water drops look when they're sitting on a flat surface. The see-through outer casing of recent iBooks came from the look that food has when it's wrapped in plastic wrap. The iPod is like a cigarette pack to those who are addicted to music instead of tobacco. This is his thinking. The sunflower inspired the iMac G4. Now, the thing is, you never hear about Johnny Ive because he is a very modest and shy person who basically seems very uncomfortable even talking about himself. Now, he's won the prestigious D&AD Award. This is a huge designer award. Actually, he's won it 6 times. And a designer, to even win it once, is just an enormous honor. It's a worldwide award. When he goes and wins that award, he doesn't even go up to receive it. Steve Jobs goes up, receives the award for him, and makes the acceptance speech on his behalf, even though he's sitting in the audience.
Interesting.
So he's just a kind of a shy guy. He lives modestly, inhabiting a 2-bedroom house in Twin Peaks, San Francisco, with his wife, Heather, who's a historian, and their 2 twin sons. So now you know the name of the man behind all of the Apple designs. One man, Jonathan Paul Ive.
Very interesting, and I've been looking around while you're talking about him. I can't find any pictures of the toilets that he designed.
I'd like to see the toilet.
Yeah, well, we'll have to keep
looking. Well, there is a story about the toilet. Okay, they actually lost the toilet contract. He went in, he designed...
So they flushed it, huh?
No. This is really outside of the scope of the... But he went to make a presentation to the director of marketing at the toilet company.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of marketing sat and watched him demonstrate his new innovative toilet. But the director of marketing had a red clown's nose stuck on his nose as he was watching the presentation. So Johnny knew they were in trouble.
I would say that's definite trouble.
After that, he went to Apple. In honor of the Culinary Arts Department, we have a food science section. Today, we're going to talk about cooking with alcohol.
Yes, a little appropriate music. Does it make you hungry?
Now, the question is, whenever you cook with alcohol, how much alcohol is left after you finish cooking? Well, I can answer that. You know, when I go out and cook a steak out on the grill, I normally take a glass of wine with me. And when mm-hmm. that steak's finished, my wine glass is empty. So
that's how you know when dinner's ready.
So when I'm finished cooking my wine there, or my cooking my steak, there is no alcohol left. But
but the two never really meet.
The two never
until
really meet.
Until you eat the steak.
So, yeah. Oh, cooking. Now when you want to put alcohol in the food.
Oh, that's different.
Yeah, that's a little different thing. So the question is, when you put alcohol in a product, how much alcohol is really left? You know, because people said, well, you know, don't worry about it because all the alcohol cooks off. Well, I did a little research. I checked the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Nutrient Data Laboratory results, and they actually put alcohol in food and they cooked it at various times, mm-hmm. and they determined how much alcohol was left. Now, for instance, if you add alcohol to a boiling liquid and then immediately remove it from the heat, 85% of the alcohol stays in there, and only 15% evaporates.
Interesting.
Now, if you take if you add alcohol to a liquid and with no heat and store it overnight, only 70% is left because it's basically evaporated.
Gotcha. I mean, 30% evaporates and 70% is left. That's with no heat. Now, if you take and add it to food and simply flame it, flame the food,
like bananas Foster or whatever.
Yeah, something like
alcohol
that.
And you light it.
As you'd expect, most of the alcohol's in there. 75% stays in the food. Now, if you bake it for 25 minutes and you don't stir while you're baking it, 45% of the alcohol remains and 55% evaporates. Now, I would have thought you bake something for 25 minutes, all the alcohol's gone. So that might be, like a rum cake or something.
Right.
Could be a rum cake, half the alcohol still in that rum cake.
This is interesting because I always thought that you cook with it, it's gone.
That's not true. That's right. Now, if you bake or simmer alcohol and you stir it and you bake or simmer it for 15 minutes, 40% of the alcohol remains.
Mm-hmm.
If you bake and simmer it for 30 minutes, 35% of the alcohol remains. If you do it for an hour, 25% of the alcohol remains. If you do it for 2.5 hours, 5% of the alcohol still remains. So there you go. There is always alcohol left in the food after you cook it. Now
here's another thing. A friend of mine asked me, why would you cook with vodka if vodka has no flavor? Vodka sauce.
Interesting. Well, it turns out alcohol actually does produce a chemical reaction in a dish. For instance, you could add vodka to marinades because it helps break down and tenderize meats. It's actually kind of acidic. You could add vodka to a cheese and cream sauce because it lowers the boiling point and it helps prevent curdling.
There we go.
Isn't that interesting?
That's the answer, isn't it?
You could also use vodka to deglaze pans. Sometimes you've got things in the bottom. You add a little alcohol to them. Mm-hmm. You deglaze it, and it dissolves and imparts an alcohol-soluble flavor to the foods or sauces. So you actually, it's a very nice deglazing method. Now, if you just add it to the last minute, you do get a slight burst of flavor, like in a flambé, if you want to flame it up.
Mm-hmm.
And you can flame it up. But those are, so you need to get the flame, you can do the deglazing, you can lower the boiling point, or you can use it for marinade function. So it does serve a purpose.
Fascinating. Never would have known. It was all there for flavor, and it's not. There's a good reason for everything.
No, I usually use alcohol in my Bloody Mary while I'm cooking breakfast.
There's another.
That's real.
Pass the bottle, Doc.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the alcohol? Where's the alcohol liquor here? The alcohol
this
cabinet in the studio here
would be a radio station, and that would be verboten.
So
when you bring it in, you're kind of breaking rules and stuff.
So it was a good thing that I brought it in my briefcase.
In the paper bag inside the briefcase.
Okay,
that's right.
Very
Boone's
good.
Farm, and it's in a box.
That's classy,
with a capital K, Doc.
Well, I was reading about beer. Beer's kind of an interesting deal.
Uh-huh.
Staying on the alcohol flavor,
mm-hmm.
alcohol theme, beer actually comes from a Middle English word, beer. It comes from the Latin word bibere, which means to drink.
Interesting. That makes sense.
In ancient Babylonian records indicate that beer was being used as a sacrificial ritual. All of the ancient cultures, including those in Egypt, China, and India, and the Incas in Peru, made beer. Now, this is the thing that I didn't know. Teuton brides drank honey beer for a month after their wedding ceremony.
Teuton, not Teuton brides.
Yeah, no,
okay,
Teuton.
That's different.
Yeah.
All right.
Teuton, they drank honey beer for a month after their wedding ceremony.
Oh, you mean Teutons if you drink honey beer.
As an aphrodisiac.
Mm-hmm.
The custom of honey beer for a month was poetically referred to as a moon and led to the current term honeymoon.
So after a month, it's over, huh?
After a month, it's over.
Boy, the bad news just keeps piling up here
in the virtual faculty lounge. But if you keep drinking that beer, maybe you can extend it a little bit longer. That is the key. So you can driven to drink.
That's it for this week on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or